Folks, there's a big difference between being the best of the best and being the best of the best of the best. And that difference is Claymore.
We're gonna talk about Comics from Devil's Due. It's something you wondered if Talking Joe would ever do. I guess we'll explain it all to you. Gonna take some time to read the books we've never read. Oh, oh.
Hey, 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 it's me, Mark, and welcome to Talking Joe, the G.I. Joe Comics podcast. Some people might say a G.I. Joe Comics podcast, but not me, no sorry. Today, we'll be continuing our side quest into the miniseries and one-shots that were coming out during the America's Elite era of disavowed G.I. Joe Comics from Devil's Due. Today, it is the turn of Special Missions Brazil, from Devil's Due, which came out in May 2007, which was collected in the trade paperback from Devil's Due G.I. Joe Special Missions. Now, joining me, as usual, to talk about this, it's my co-host, it's a real Brazilian Tim, it's Tim Finn.
Hello, listeners, and hello, Mark.
Hello. Now, Tim, before you get into it, you just mustn't get confused about this issue. This is not to be confused with G.I. Joe versus Cobra Special Issue 4, Mission Brazil 2, which was published by Fun Publications in 2011 and was part of the G.I. Joe Con from 2011. Just before you do that.
I don't think I have any of the Fun Publications G.I. Joe comics. They were exclusives to the conventions or the fan club. And then many of them, I don't think all of them, some months later were republished with different covers available for the direct market for comic book stores, which was nice.
Through like Diamond Distribution sort of routes.
Yes,
For some reason, weird reason, I didn't get these as they were coming out. So I just imagine they just were off my radar, and I thought that it was something that I wouldn't be able to get from a comic shop, so didn't.
I know the reason why I didn't get them, because I did see them in Diamond Previews, and I wasn't interested for three reasons. One, I had been attending BotCon, which the same people had been running, and I was aware of the comics that were being made for the Transformers convention, and by not the same people, but sort of an analogous sort of set of Transformers people who were professionals and semi-professionals and who worked for the official fan club. And those comics were, they were pretty good, but they felt unofficial and a little amateurish. And I was always aware that the sort of comic you got at the convention was also the program for the convention.
Oh, right.
And so there'd be a short comic story. I don't remember if it was 8 pages or 16 pages, but it wasn't full length. And then this comic book you were holding also had, you know, little photos of the guests for the convention and the schedule for the convention. And I remember thinking, well, if they're republishing this whole thing as a comic book for regular comic book stores, some of it isn't content that I want to pay for. And if they're dropping that content, then you know, buying. And I think the cover price on these Fun Pub sort of reissues was $2 more than normal comics at the time, because it was sort of a limited thing. So they felt skippable.
Non-essential. Yeah.
And Larry Hama had nothing to do with any of them. Although this past week I was going through back issues at my store, and we have some boxes sort of in our storage space which are not fully sorted, and I found a Fun Publications G.I. Joe comic, and it had a plotting by one of the convention people and a script by Larry Hama. So I stand corrected.
I like that you've corrected yourself sort of mid-sentence. That's great. So we've talked a little bit about what this is not. Let's probably get into what it actually is. It's two stories, 48 pages, non-stop action. Should we take this moment to explore the meaning, relevance, cultural significance and history of G.I. Joe Special Missions Brazil, Tim?
Yes. Yes. In 1986, because Toys R Us was such a good client for Hasbro, Hasbro and Toys R Us worked out an exclusive, and it consisted of 5 G.I. Joe figures and an audio cassette. And 4 of the figures were recolored figures from that year. Figures that were new. This wasn't like Tiger Force or Night Force, where it's figures from, you know, a year and a half, 2 years earlier, 3 years earlier. This set came out in 86, and Dial Tone, Leatherneck, Mainframe, and Wetsuit in their original colors came out in 86. And then there's a new figure here who was originally going to have a new head and a new sculpt. And for cost reasons, it ended up being a reused head and a reused body with new colors.
Let's call it out. This guy is called Claymore. His head was a repaint of Footloose. His chest was a repaint of Televiper. His arms were from Flint and his legs were from Dusty.
And one way that this package was kept sort of easier to make and faster and cheaper is that there wasn't a new painting generated for it. There's no group shot of all these characters. The quote artwork for the box is just a giant window where you can see the figures and the cassette and a little bit of the accessories. And then the sort of red card that is familiar to anyone who bought a vehicle, the way that the vehicle driver or pilot was packaged.
Box kind of looks almost, it looks kind of almost amateurish compared to, you know, the high value that we got. We were used to seeing from like a carded figure or vehicle.
Yeah, it. This is mean. It looks a little cheap, and it looks a little bootleggy.
Mm.
My next door neighbor, actually, who was I think 2 years younger than me, he had Special Mission Brazil, and I think I tried to trade. I think I successfully traded for his mainframe, because in my collection I have Special Missions Brazil mainframe, but I never had the cassette. Did I also get Claymore? And as a kid, I thought these new colors were cool, and I was sort of ready for more of this to happen. And you know, Tiger Force and Night Force and Python Patrol, and it did. I don't think I've ever heard the cassette adventure, the audio adventure, but around 2005, you know, after I discovered yojo.com, I think I listened to the first minute of the audio and I thought, oh, no, thanks.
Mm-hmm.
And we so Mark, what, do you have any connection to this box set?
Not really, other than it being, you know, this interesting curiosity because we never got it in the UK, and Claymore being an exciting character because he's an all new character created for the set. So a sort of, you know, extra kind of sense of mystery to him. The cassette's fun as well because it says on it, record your own G.I. Joe Special Mission on side B. They're kind of making the fact that side B is blank and has got nothing on it as being a selling point of you can record your own adventure. And apparently some people did. I think Jason Murrell found a cassette and it did have someone recording their own adventure on side B, which is it's a kind of a joyous little thing to discover.
I did say there was no sort of new marquee art generated for this box, but I want to slightly correct that because the 4 repainted Joes in this set, on their file cards, their colors have been altered.
Uh-huh.
So Mainframe on the file card has a red helmet. Leatherneck is in beige, not green. With Dial Tone and Wetsuit, it's a little harder to see. And So, you know, we have established, we fans, that when Hasbro did repaints, the original artwork was painted over. So the original Duke painting does not exist because the Tiger Force Duke painting is on top of it, the actual art board with actual paint. And I don't know if for these four characters that happened, or if it was on, you know, some kind of copy or blow up. And we should also say that Claymore has never shown up in a G.I. Joe comic, correct?
Well, he has. He was used in the Brandon Jawa on a couple of times. And we did find out a little bit more about the creation of Claymore and the mission, the story that was on the tape, because at Assembly Required, just gone, we met Michael Charles Hill, who worked at Sunbow as a producer and writer, and he was able to help the fans for the first time discover a bit of the hidden history about his involvement in the creation of Claymore and that story.
Yes, so Hill, because he was a producer on the show, he was the person who Hasbro or Griffin Bacall, the ad agency, picked to write this audio adventure. And I think he was saying that he never got a sample of it.
You know, I think that's right, yeah.
He acquired one much more recently. And there were some fun sort of Easter eggs where, if I'm remembering correctly, Claymore is named after someone, a real person. And Hill picked Brazil because his wife was, help me out, I'm trying to remember. His wife translated Brazilian songs into English, or translated English songs into Spanish or Portuguese. You can learn all about that by tracking down the Michael Charles Hill panel from Assembly Required 2023 on YouTube.
Or to even talk to Michael Charles Hill if you're going to Joe Fest this summer, because he has been announced as one of the guests.
I didn't say this, but I should. Claymore's art looks like it is quite sort of redone. Mm-hmm. Again, the package doesn't show the full body artwork of these characters. It just shows the head and shoulders on their file cards. Claymore's art looks like
it's a reworking of the Footloose art.
Yes. I, as a kid, I sort of assumed that there would be more of these. I did not own it, but I do have a faint recollection of being at Toys R Us and seeing it, and maybe even holding it and thinking, this is cool, maybe I want this. And I just sort of assumed that, you know, there'd be more special missions with other locales and other audio adventures, perhaps, and other sets of recolored characters. Okay, but just to put a fine point on it, there was no official pack-in comic book with the original Special Missions Brazil boxed set. Larry Hama never used the character, and the character certainly never appeared in animation. And because this was an exclusive, the animation never referred to these versions of these characters. And so Claymore first shows up in the Brandon Jawa run at Devil's Due.
Yeah, it's an interesting point, isn't it, that Claymore is one of the few G.I. Joe characters from this era where the file card would not have been written by Larry Hama. And that is probably a large part related to why Hama never used him as a character, because I guess he would be less on his radar as someone that he's actually created himself.
Yeah, that's a good point. I remember, I think as a kid, I asked my brother what that code name meant, and he said, it's a kind of landmine. And then 2 or 3 years later, I was watching the CBS TV show Tour of Duty and reading the Nom. And this is now, I think Hama is no longer editor on the book by the time I start reading it. I start reading around issue 40. And not only does, between that show and the comic, not only is what a claymore is explained. There's even a cover. And in fact, the cover of issue 25 of The Nom, which is penciled and inked by Ron Wagner, is of a claymore. And the story behind this cover, the story in the cover, I should say, right? So claymore is sort of shaped like a lunchbox, if the landmines you're used to are the ones that come with the G.I. Joe character Tripwire, right? Not little discs. And you sort of plant it, and there's a tripwire, and part of it says front toward enemy. And if someone trips the tripwire, if you can sort of imagine a lunchbox, but perhaps a little skinnier, and it explodes outward, like your lunchbox would open. If you sort of put your lunchbox down, you know, you're holding the handle, your metal lunchbox, on a table. And so the shrapnel goes out towards where the tripwire was stripped. And what would happen sometimes during the conflict in Vietnam is the enemy would find claymores and turn them backwards. And so the cover of issue 25 of The Nom, penciled and inked by Ron Wagner, shows this happening, even though it's a little unclear if you don't understand the context.
Should we get on to the contents of this issue now?
Yeah.
So this is split into two stories. I think we'll tackle each story on its own. So let's have a look at the front of the comic first of all, and those things that they call covers.
Let's have a look at the covers in the gallery.
Cover A, Special Missions Brazil, is drawn by Valentine Delandro and Pat Davidson, with colors by Spetru, with assists by Tim Seeley. And I don't think we know what that means. Tim Seeley assisting here. Maybe something had to be redrawn a little bit and he redrew it. Maybe there was a weapon and it got whited out and he redrew a hand or something like that. So the cover is, interestingly, it refers to the B story, not the A story. And this is a really fun cover. It shows Cover Girl and Shipwreck under attack, but definitely beating a bunch of cobra eels. And this is happening on a whale out in the water. A lot of the cover, if you took away the logo, is just a light blue sky. So there's no sense of land or other ships. We don't know sort of how far out into the water we are. There are several eels knocked out, lying by these Joe's feet, having already been dispatched. One's getting kicked, one's getting punched, one's climbing up onto the whale, and another one much closer to us, the audience, is coming out of the water with that cool harpoon gun also coming out of the water. And I like the poses. I like the composition. I like who's in it. I like so much about this cover. It's drawn handsomely, but it also, I don't know quite how to say this. Okay, well, one, I find the colors to be subtly a little pasty for my taste. There's a lot of white mixed into every color in the rendering, and that keeps this from being more bold. And then similarly, the ink lines are quite thin and delicate, which are handsome, but also sort of keep this from having a little more heft and being more bold, particularly with this cobra eel, the top of the head and the weapon that's closest to us. I'd like some thicker black outlines to separate elements. But it's a fun cover, and it does nicely sell the contents of the story.
I reached out to cover artist / interior artist on the main story, Valentine Delandro, to ask what memories he had from this book. So here's what he had to say.
Hi, Mark. This is Valentine Delandro. Thank you for having me on Talking Joe. Say a few words about G.I. Joe Special Missions Brazil. That was quite some time ago, but had a lot of fun. I mean, memorable things about that, first of all, was the cover. I mean, I got to draw Shipwreck, which and Cover Girl, two of my favorite Joes, about to be attacked and fighting off a bunch of cobra eels. That was great. That was a really great cover for me, really early in my career. Anytime you get to work on Joe is a big treat. But I also remember working with Michael Sullivan, and his energy, his enthusiasm was infectious. I really had a good time working with him. It was a great project. Again, anything to do with G.I. Joe, I always find it memorable, and it's a great experience for me. So yeah, thanks for having me on, Mark.
Thanks, Valentin, for that contribution. And back to Tim.
And then there's a variant cover. It's got the Brazilian flag as a design element in the background. So green with sort of a yellow diamond and a purple circle with some stars in it. And then the Tim Seeley character art for the data desk files, the character profiles that show up halfway through this comic book of these Joes, each sort of standing there with, you know, no background, but they've been sort of comped in together. Those are the characters that make up this cover. And then there's a little bit of sort of distressed, sort of fake, like scratchiness added to the green. And this is, it's funny because the colors from the backgrounds make this color, make this cover a lot more bold and sort of pop. But again, the coloring on the characters is really pasty. There's a lot of white used in all of these, in all these colors. And these profiles are all penciled only and not inked. So the lines are really thin and delicate.
And we spoke to the writer of this comic and also Devil's Due publisher, Sam Wells, and he gave us a little bit of an inside scoop on how this second cover came about.
So Michael Sullivan wrote the backup story, which was 8 pages long, and my story was the lead-in, which I think was 28 to 30 pages. And then when it came for solicitations for Diamond for the direct copy, he was like, oh, well, I just got this image made of Shipwreck and Cover Girl for the cover. I'm like, oh, that's cool. That's the backup story and your story, but okay. But at the time I commanded the print runs, and I had a lead on like what we could do for con covers, or this one that's on right now is the web store cover. So I was like, all right, well, we're doing a small print run of a web store cover, and it's going to be my team, and it's going to be more expensive, very small print run, and people are going to hunt for this one now. And secondary market, it's up there.
This, yeah. Brazil cover with the green background, is this supposed to look like a paperback book with some scratches or shine on the left and right?
Yeah, yeah. That. So this was Sean Dove designing this for me, and I feel like this was just where he was at this point in time, design wise. He was like, "Let's make it look worn." I'm like, "Oh, okay. I just care about these characters getting on the cover." And so he was pulling the data desk images for this and repainting them, just changing the color to match the Mission Brazil stuff. But wetsuit, as you see in the back there, his legs, he wasn't drawn in the data desk files with legs. He was drawn swimming. So like he had the flippers on and everything, but we needed him standing on land. That's why he's pushed to the back, and he has America's Elite Flint's legs. Just to match, give him a gray and match.
So let's look at the first story. Special Missions Brazil is the name. Writer, Sam Wells. Pencils, Valentin Delandro. Colors, Gary Henderson with Taisha Stevenson. Letters, Brian J. Crowley. And editor, Mike O'Sullivan.
Plot breakdown.
Years ago, a Joe team of Claymore, Mainframe, Wetsuit, Leatherneck, and Dialtone were on a mission tracking down Headman and his headhunters. It was a mission that they felt had some unfinished business. Years later, the team get a pre-recorded message from the deceased Mainframe, alerting them that the team should reunite to take on Headman. I'll take this moment to note that Mainframe died in the second Cobra Island Civil War in G.I. Joe issue 25. And Firewall joins the team in place of Mainframe to help them finally capture Headman.
What is your top-down reaction to this story, Mark?
There's a couple of things that sort of strike me. My thoughts are the art looks quite different. It looks like it's mostly sort of scanned from pencils, and that sort of gives it quite a sort of an illustrative quality to it. It does, and sort of combined with the coloring technique, which is kind of quite sort of painterly. It sort of does look different to the standard look of G.I. Joe, and I think for the most part is quite, the art's quite handsome, but not necessarily very punchy. The story is interesting, that sort of framing of then and now, the sort of the past mission and then sort of the team coming back together and sort of acknowledging that their teammate Mainframe is no longer there. So there's sort of a lot of connection to the sort of the past of G.I. Joe as well as the present. But I think the overall story didn't necessarily excite me possibly as much as I'd have hoped. So slightly mixed.
I think I agree with everything you've just said. I wanted to take a step back and just point out how tickled I was to be reading this comic, because something's always been missing, that those toys never got mentioned anywhere. Yeah. You know, like in the same way that I'm, you know, Night Force has never been properly mentioned because that was a Toys R Us exclusive. But Tiger Force shows up in the Marvel comic. It's sort of sideways. You know, they don't call it out as a specific thing that they're going to do. You know, Duke doesn't recruit a couple Joes for Tiger Force. I don't remember them speaking about the vehicles as anything particular. Just Larry had to use them, so Larry throws them in. Slaughter's Marauders plays a big part in Operation Dragonfire, Deke's first five episodes that aired in September of 89. And, you know, nowadays, these recolor sub-teams are such an expected part of the brand that, you know, anytime a licensee does, you know, like a Destro trash can, there's going to be a profit director Destro trash can. And anyone that makes a Duke toy is definitely going to make a Tiger Force Duke toy. And even though I never had the original Brazil box set, I've always wanted to see these characters, even for just one quick scene, put on these other costumes and maybe go to Brazil. So that the cover doesn't promise it. I'm talking about the A cover, but the title hints at it. And then page one, just there we are. Like, wait, Mainframe's got his red helmet. Yes. I finally, you know, I've talked a lot about how I take in G.I. Joe as color, as colors, as color combinations. And, you know, not everyone loves all of the color combinations. You know, oh, they get too neon, or, you know, oh, everyone should be green like 82. So I love the, I don't even want to call it fan service. I just feel like it's sort of a promise long ago now kept on page one. And Delandro, I think you described it well, draws faces really well, but is definitely drawing in a more realistic and photorealistic style. And I don't actually think these are photo, I don't know if these are photo referenced. They don't jump out at me as photo referenced in a bad way, if they are photo referenced, but they do jump out at me as someone who's very aware of facial anatomy in a way that most comic book artists are not. Most comic book artists are, to a greater extent or a lesser extent, simplifying faces so they become sort of stock characters. You know, like if you flip through, you know, Fantastic Four by Kirby or Byrne or Waringo, you know, you have a couple faces that repeat, and it's sort of like the costume and the hair that changes. And it's not just Fantastic Four, it's most comics. And, you know, the cheekbones and the noses and the way that brows are furrowed here in this G.I. Joe comic, they are particular to each character. It's quite handsome and technically accomplished. I also find it a little distracting. And I wish Delandro, in drawing this, would do a little bit more of this simplifying and a little bit less of this illustrative approach. And I just want to point out that, so, you know, this is 2007. Delandro went on, did Marvel Knights 4 and drew some X-Factor, the Peter David X-Factor, and is Canadian. But if you've been reading Image Comics in the last 10 years, then maybe you know Bitch Planet, which Delandro co-created with Kelly Sue DeConnick, right, and still sells at my store, even though Kelly Sue DeConnick mostly left comics for television. And I think there was more Bitch Planet that was going to happen. And yet, you know, we still sell the two volumes and the spinoff volume. And so Delandro's later work does have some thicker lines and some somewhat bolder of a visual approach. I also think that even though his storytelling is clear and his acting is good, it's not just the sort of this thing where I'm describing in the faces that are so carefully drawn that I'm a little distracted. It's a little bit of sort of everything that, you know, when the headman shows up, the sort of half splash page, he has his head tipped back. And that's a really hard angle to draw faces at and to do it well. And I think technically Delandro does it well, but it sort of also looks a little weird. And, you know, on the next page, here and there, there's some characters that are knocked out as silhouettes, and that reads a little bit like a hole in the page rather than something that's fully black, because almost nothing else in this story is fully black because of the pencil rendering and then the colors that are rendered on top of it. And then I also thought that having Firewall show up and spiritually, as a spiritual successor to Mainframe, take his place on the mission and wear a version of his costume is really fun and maybe sort of unrealistic and distracting. You know, like, I don't know why she would go to the locker room at Joe headquarters and like pull out her red helmet. I don't know that the story logic requires it. Although earlier they do refer to them being sort of undercover and not being recognized because they're in alternate costumes. And I really appreciate that bit of dialogue and logic from Sam Wells, because you don't have to explain color changes, you know, like if a Hiss is black or red or blue, like, well, it's the Mark IV. It's like, no, you could give us something. It's because it's the Mark IV. But considering that I've not been a big fan of Firewall, I thought that filling that gap that was missing because of Mainframe's absence and then having her visually kind of literally take his place is a lovely sort of G.I. Joe visual and continuity gesture. Mm. I was sort of hoping in the present tense, in the present day, before we see the headman again, I was sort of hoping that the modern version of him would be that orange costume with the black pinstripes from the G.I. Joe versus Cobra 2-pack, which I don't know if that's from 2003 or 4, maybe. So tell me, Mark, when we do see Headman now, is this an invented costume?
Yeah, I think this is the first and only time that this costume arrives. So I imagine it is a collaboration between the writer and artist to come up with a new and sort of more modern look to differentiate the now from the past. And I guess with it being a white suit, sort of black shirt, open collar, I guess leaning in a little bit into the tropes of the Al Pacino Scarface type look.
Or because he has a cane, I was also thinking a little bit of the pimp.
Kingpin as well?
Oh, well, yes. But I was thinking he's a little bit like he's a pimp.
Mm. Yeah.
I don't think he's trafficking in people and sex. I think he's just a drug dealer. But, you know, you look at this costume and you don't think, that's a good guy.
No, that's true.
I do wish that in his modern iteration, he still had his facial hair. Because this is one of those, you know, character visual that, you know, I'm really particular about in G.I. Joe. I think if characters had mustaches or beards in the 80s and you redo them now, it's okay if you go to a goatee. But I don't want Roadblock to lose his mustache or his goatee. And I don't really want Lowlight to go from being a blonde with a clean shaven blonde to having black hair and a beard and mustache, because then it starts to feel like Airborne and Airborne, like two separate guys.
Different guys, yeah. And between the past scenes and the present scenes, they switch from using headhunters to headhunter stormtroopers. So those guys in berets versus sort of slightly more sort of Star Warsy looking armored guys with sort of skull helmets and studded shoulder pads and stuff. So I guess it's kind of a nice way of saying, well, that was then, and we had these guys in the berets, and now we've got these hardcore Mad Max type looking sort of goons. And I think this is the first time that we've seen these characters being used in the comics. They were 1993, which was the year after the original Headhunter had come out. They were intended to be part of the DEF drug elimination force subset, but were packaged as Battle Corps, as Hasbro had kind of abandoned that sort of subline in.
I wanted to agree with you, even though the Headhunters and the Headhunter Stormtroopers figures are only separated originally by a year, I appreciate that here, using them as for different eras, is another visual accentuating of the time that has passed and that, you know, characters have upgraded or have different costumes. I thought that was a very nice touch. In terms of new costumes, I was really thrown off when I turned the page from the end of the past mission to modern day with Sparks in the rock. And he gets this video message from the past, but not too much in the past, from Mainframe. And Mainframe is in this very high-tech costume. And I was thrown off for two reasons. And I bet you can guess one of them. And the second reason is because I hadn't remembered Mainframe in this Devil's Due redesign costume. And it's sort of too tech futuristic for me. For a second, I thought, is this Star Brigade sci-fi? Not that Star Brigade sci-fi had this sort of headgear and like ribbing on his shoulders, but it's, you know, this look or actually 1986 sci-fi. You can imagine him wearing some insulation under his helmet and under his green RoboCop suit. But, you know, the guy who shows up here, to me, doesn't look like a G.I. Joe. He looks like a fancy scientist tech person that G.I. Joe has to rescue that Cobra's going to assassinate.
It looks a little bit too much like a kind of a Marvel comic superhero design to a character. And I didn't like this redesign of Mainframe that they'd introduced in the early days of Devil's Due. But, you know, given that they're trying to be faithful to the canon that exists, this is the Mainframe that they've got, who was about before he died. So you know, they're using the right Mainframe. It's just for the Devil's Due era comic, but it's not necessarily the best.
Yes, they are right in doing it, and I thought, okay. Mark, tell our listeners the other reason why I was thrown off when Mainframe shows up.
I don't know.
Oh, because a single piece of art is copied and pasted three more times. Your comics artists are allowed to do that because it saves time and drawing comics is hard. But I always find it a little distracting because in my mind, that's as if you're watching a movie and you press pause, not that someone is standing in front of you and like isn't moving. Because they're still like breathing and blinking. And I feel like, you know, an artist in this position should redraw the head and shoulders, even if it's basically the same position. Or, you know, you cock their head and you have their eyebrow go up and you open their mouth a little differently to the next panel and the next panel.
I am kicking myself for not calling this out, because as I was reading it, I did think to myself, oh no, Tim's not going to like that. But there we go.
So tell me, okay, I see. All right, so in that first panel, Sparks has several big monitors in front of him and a small laptop next to him. And that's almost like the literal data desk. Now I understand. Below him on the page, he's looking at the at the laptop. On the next page, the first two panels, he's looking at the laptop. And then in the third panel, they're both looking at the six big monitors on the wall. Mm-hmm. That's why there are those lines through it. Okay, now I understand.
Yeah, they look a bit like barbed wire or something.
Yeah, or I thought maybe for a second it was like static in the video. But it's, you know, six monitors are combining to create one big monitor. That's what's happening.
One of the most boring Transformers toys ever.
Monitor. Actually, it's Combiner Wars. The cathode ray tubitrons combine to form Monitron. These six cubes just stick together to be a larger cube. Okay. I wanted to say one more quick thing about color, which is, and costumes. In the modern part of the story, Wetsuit is in beige, and Leatherneck, in wearing his old Brazil beige version of his green costume. The scene where they all get together, the panel before Firewall shows up, I see dial tone, beige guy, and beige guy. And I thought, oh no, I'm losing track of who's who, because Claymore's not wearing the green part of his costume that really sticks out, and Leatherneck's mustache is really tiny. And then a couple pages later, Leatherneck and Wetsuit are waiting for something to happen, and then Wetsuit sort of tackles Leatherneck and says, "Get down." And you know, I like that they bicker. It's like from the second season of the cartoon. And Wetsuit would wear something like this. He wouldn't run around in his actual wetsuit, which is something that my brother pointed out to me when we were kids. Speaking of Michael Charles Hill, when the episode Ninja Holiday aired and Wetsuit is walking around for the whole thing in like a light blue button up or white short sleeve shirt and like blue pants, he sort of looks like Shipwreck as if he shaved. And I remember saying something like, "Why isn't he wearing his wetsuit?" And my brother said, "Well, he's a Navy SEAL. Like he wouldn't always run around in an actual wetsuit." And also then the figure Muskrat was released. And my brother said, "This is what Wetsuit would wear sometimes, this kind of thing." Anyway, but there's the scene in this comic where even though Leatherneck and Wetsuit are a real contrast, one's a Navy, one's a Marine, they bicker. They're both in beige and it's a little hard to tell them apart.
I was just going to say as well, in G.I. Joe, as written by Larry Hammer, a Wetsuit also appears in sort of similar sort of garb. But to your other points, one of the, I think, the highlights of this story is that there's sort of some just nice character interplay. There's sort of some dialogue and the sort of back and forth on dialogue between characters that you don't always see in G.I. Joe. So it is nice when you're sort of seeing those more rounded characters and sort of some of that jokey interplay, like on the page that we're looking at now. You sure you'll be able to rig this up properly without being submerged in some sort of liquid? I think I could manage. Yeah, because I could, if you need, I could spit on you while you work. Why, Miss Marine, spitting isn't very becoming of a lady. Nice, yeah, it's nice.
Yeah, yeah, nice, good stuff. Nicely done. Nice character work. But even though I like the character work on pages 6 and 7 and 8, character code names get abbreviated to Neck, Suit, Wets, and Tone. And I've said this before on Talking Joe, I don't think Larry Hama ever did this in the Marvel run. Chuck Dixon was doing it in his IDW run. And I think if I was a Joe, I would do this. So I understand the logic of it. I don't actually like it. Mm-hmm. And I know that in a lot of situations, you're like running from Cobra and their explosions. And you might, if someone's got a three-syllable name, you might just use one of them. But in my mind, they call each other by their code names. They don't have nicknames. You know, like no one's going to call Sparks Sparky. No one's going to call Roadblock RB, you know. So it's okay. I don't love it. Mm-hmm. There's a storytelling thing I wanted to point out. On page 3, the bottom panel, which is actually two panels, we're looking at Mainframe from behind his head and shoulders. And on the left half, we're seeing in what in film is called a matte shot, M-A-T-T-E, where it's like you're looking through a keyhole or binoculars and most of the screen or panel is black, but then you've got this cutout shape. And it's because a mat has been cut. And so we're seeing what he's seeing through binoculars on the left, which is more bad guys or bad guys on a boat. And then on the right side, he's looking to the right, and there's just sort of a dark thing over his shoulder, which kind of looks like a hill in the distance. And so then one, two pages later, there's a silhouette of him with what is definitely binoculars up to his eyes, and then another sort of POV shot, a POV panel of the matte binoculars shape. And I realize now that page three panel on the bottom, which is really two panels, he is holding binoculars where he says, I'd say they're either hiding something or have no idea what they're getting themselves into. Those are his hands, gloves and binoculars, but they're colored so dark. It's like a dark blue for the gloves and a dark green. And they're held so low and cropped by his shoulder that they don't read. And this is one of those cases where I look at this and I say, I'm sure this was a lot clearer on a monitor. Like the colorist who did this, it was much clearer to them looking at a computer, and it just was going to print much darker. And, you know, colorists, beware of K, beware of adding black. That's not how you make colors darker. You don't do it by adding black. And be gentle with artwork that's already been done in ink wash or in like pencil gradients. And, you know, it's always helpful if something is inked, not just penciled, to have a thicker outline on, in this case, the shoulder, to push those hands and binoculars back. And, you know, for the artist, I'd like him to pull the hands up a little bit more.
True. I had a couple of things still on my list to flag on this one. Basically, I spies. Headman, he was last seen in Marvel issue 127. I had thought to myself that he actually had died in the Marvel run, but I was misremembering. In that issue, Headman is on a boat bringing in another drug shipment to Broker Beach, I think it is, and Cobra Commander has a Techno Viper take control of the G.I. Joe satellite laser to shoot Headman's boat, and then the DEF sort of fish out the headhunters and Headman from the water. So that's the last time that we see Headman before this point in the comic being fished out of the water.
And this comic includes a scan of a Marvel panel.
True.
On a
monitor or something.
On a computer monitor.
Mm-hmm. Also on the Headman Identified Threats data desk page, there's a picture of him from the ARAR book. My other I spy was just the reappearance of Rashid, who was introduced in G.I. Joe from Marvel, issue 58.
Is this technically an I spy if there's an asterisk, if there's a footnote, an asterisk pointing you to that?
It's not really an I spy, but I'll mention it.
It's a noteworthy return appearance.
Exactly.
This one feels like, remind me, what was the Devil's Due issue we read where someone from, was it Special Missions issue 4? Someone who was piloting a boat?
Sarawak Sally, are you thinking of?
Yeah, maybe that. Am I remembering this right?
Sarawak Sally, she appeared in G.I. Joe by Larry Hama as part of the Murder by Assassination arc.
Oh, right, okay, not Devil's Due.
The issue that S.L. Gallant drew, which was just a strange reappearance after such a long protracted period where the character had never been used before.
Right. All right, I wanted to point out a couple more things in this story on page 7. Recently in Talking Joe, when referring to a new issue of the Larry Hama book from Skybound, I pointed out an example where I thought that the artist wasn't telling Larry Hama's plot clearly enough, and that I thought Hama had to add some dialogue to sort of clarify what was happening. And I think I'm seeing that happen here on page 7, where this is right after the headman points and a headhunter has a rocket launcher. And then there's this panel of sort of a Dutch angle, Brakoom! And either that same headhunter and the headman, or that same headhunter and another random headhunter are getting sort of thrown off the ground that's exploding. And the one with the rocket launcher is pointing the rocket launcher up, but the trail of smoke is going down. So his shot just got messed up, and his bird balloon says, "Ugh, what was that? It messed up my shot." And then in the next panel, you see a trail of smoke and a rocket is going into the distance and exploding past Claymore and Dialtone. And I got to that bit of dialogue and I thought, woof. I thought, this artist is good enough to pull this off, and either there's sort of too much plot being asked of this page, and the artist across these two panels didn't sort of clearly enough show that the ground shakes, the guy firing the rocket gets thrown off balance, his aim is off, the rocket goes in the wrong direction, or he just needed to divide one of these panels into one more panel. But something, this jumped out at me as a little conspicuous. And then on page 17, when the Joes are going into Rashid's underground surprise high-tech bunker, what's her name? Firewall says, "Wow, Radio Hut doesn't have anything on you." And this kind of thing always disappoints me. And I really feel for Sam Wells, the writer here, because I can totally imagine him writing in the script, "Wow, Radio Shack doesn't have anything on you." And then the editor at Devil's Due or someone at Hasbro says, no, you can't use the actual name because, you know, they might sue us because we're, you know, we didn't get permission, or like, oh, well, you know, we're actually partnering with their competition and we don't want to give them a little bit of free advertising, you know, whatever it is. This kind of thing happens in comics, in entertainment a lot, even in the world we live in where, you know, like every character shows up in Wreck-It Ralph 2 or like Ready Player One from all these other companies. You still have cases where, you know, a company will say, no, don't use that brand name. And the joke is sort of, the reference doesn't make as much sense. Although in another way, Radio Shack is gone now. And I read this for this episode and I thought, if younger readers are reading this comic now, they don't know what Radio Hut or Radio Shack is. So what's Firewall talking about?
I've been watching Young Sheldon with the family, and that is like his sort of, what would be the word that you would use for a special sacred place? It's his church, I guess, his place that he goes to for spiritual fulfillment, to go to Radio Shack.
Oh, does the show cut to a set that they have built to look like a Radio Shack from 10
presumably,
or 15 years ago?
Presumably, okay. Yeah.
I wonder, 'cause Radio Shack is gone. It's out of business, but someone certainly still owns that name, the way that Pan Am is no longer an airline that you can fly, but a company owns that name. So you have to pay if you want to, you know, use it in your like flashback for a movie or something. All right. Two other little points. When the mission in the past ends, the Joes seem a little dejected, mm-hmm. and Claymore gives them a pep talk. "We did too, Leatherneck. We were able to take valuable intel back to headquarters, the Brazilian government, and the DEA. That's worth a lot more than what we're giving ourselves credit for. Nothing to shake a stick at, guys." And the scene ends with a wordless panel of all five Joes, and Delandro doesn't draw any faces. And we're far enough back that he sort of gets away with it. But even though from context, I understand what is happening in this panel feels like Delandro just ran out of time or sort of missed the emotional beat that's being expressed here, because what I need from more of these Joes is either like dejected body language, like looking down, slumping forward, or sort of the opposite of it, like, "Hey, you know, he's right," you know, like maybe not a high five or like an arm around someone, but something. This final panel is really underdrawn, and for being a wordless panel that's supposed to let, if this is a movie, like the scene run for a couple seconds and all you'd hear is just like the helicopter in the background, because of the art, it falls flat. So I know what's happening, but I was disappointed by it.
Mm. Yeah, I don't know if this is what you're taking away from it, but it's like he's given a pep talk, trying to say, you know, it feels like we've not done so well, but we've got to win. But feels like maybe that's just landing a bit flat, that you're saying these words, but yeah, we're still feeling pretty crappy about this mission.
Yes. And then, interestingly, the final panel of the story, I thought the beats of the final two panels of the story were great, that they get to right or wrong, sort of they captured the headman and they hadn't in the past. There's a nice bit of acting in the final four panels where Delandro has Firewall standing there with the helmet, take off the helmet, and then holding the helmet, and then a close-up that shows the helmet. And that's a really nice progression, while the dialogue refers to not just that they got to complete this mission years later after all, but also do right by Mainframe, who wasn't here to see it. That's all great. Interesting. And it's a nice final panel. And I thought, yeah, particularly since I've always been so struck, right? Which Special Missions Brazil figure did I trade my next door neighbor for? Mainframe. Red Helmet has always really struck me. But interestingly, though Delandro seems to have drawn the hand and the helmet in the final panel as a new piece of art, the bit of Dialtone's hand and sleeve and pants on the left side of the final panel under the word balloon is a big blow up of a bit of art from the previous panel. And I wonder if, like, the colorist did that as a little art fix. Like, no, the camera's pulled in close, or pushed in close, on Firewall's hand, glove, and Mainframe's helmet. But Dialtone's still close enough we'd see some Dialtone. Like, well, let me just grab a little art from the previous panel, paste it, and blow it up. But it's blown up so much, the line really breaks up. And in a way that is inconsistent with the bit of art of Mainframe's helmet and Firewall's hand. This is not me, like, shaking my fist, like, you guys ruined it. It's just a small, like, you know, inconsistent technical thing.
This is probably a good segue, actually, because a little while back, we did speak to Sam Wells in some depth about the process of creating this issue. And he does actually touch on this final page and why that final panel looks a little bit strange. So let's hear what Sam has to say, and he'll explain what happened with that final panel.
Yeah, and I think this was the second to last. I think the last Special Missions was Cobra, and this was the last one that was sitting on our board at the time, and it didn't have a writer attached to it. And it, at that point, it would have just been Special Missions book this month. And I was like, hey, I don't know why, but we haven't done Brazil yet, and there's already characters to plug into this one. So this one's like half written.
Did you have the Operation Brazil set as a kid?
Not as a kid. At the time that I wrote this, I did.
Okay.
Yeah. No, I missed that as a youngster. But I, you know, first thing I did when I was pitching doing Brazil as Special Missions, I went back to Yojo and I listened to the audio recording they had on there of the tape. And I was like, oh, this is horrible. We can't do this. It's like Baroness, Cobra Commander, and Destro riding in a raft to grab a satellite or something like that. I was like, I can't make a whole story out of that. Like, that's, yeah.
Was there a brief second where you were like, we could do something about a satellite, maybe just a bit better?
Yeah. But I think I just wanted to bring Headman in because, you know, I mean, how much had he gotten in the past, like, 20 years in Joe books? So it was cool to throw him down there. And I actually didn't realize at the time when the book came out, like, and I asked for, like, Brazilian troops, and what I got was NATO troops. I didn't realize that when the book was published. Like, the guys coming in with the light blue helmets, that's NATO. And I was just like, cool. I had no idea.
Okay, so this is a good segue. All right, so as a kid, you had read some comics, not a ton of comics. As a Devil's Due employee, you were devouring comics and helping to make comics. And now you were writing a couple stories. So did you have any particular requests or ideas about what you wanted in the art or the visual storytelling? Or were you just sort of leaving it to the artists and the sort of Devil's Due, like, pipeline?
Yeah, there were a couple. I wish I had Brazil right in front of me. There were a couple things that you lay out how you visually want it to look. If not, you just say who's on the page, who's saying what. You know, what I remember is page one and page 20. Oh, here I have the final page here, that like the original artwork. So it was 25 pages. So page one and page 25. I remember specific things from that. Where page one, I laid it out how I wanted it to look, like with the opening scene and all that. But what Valentine turned in, he added at the bottom all five of the dudes on the roster. And I was like, that's brilliant. Like, that's great. You're showing all their faces up front. I love it. So that was the one change that he made that I was like, oh, that's thank you very much for taking some liberties there. And then the thing with the last page, what's printed is much different than what was drawn, because Hasbro was not happy with, let me grab it and see if I can actually show it. There's a lot of Firewall's butt there in that last panel. Here we go. Yeah. And what's printed is cropped. So it's mostly just the hand with the helmet there. Like when it went for approval, Hasbro was like, nope, because it's a butt. We can't have butts.
Now back to G.I. Joe.
There we go. That was great talking to Sam. And yeah, I don't know whether necessarily the story necessarily needed a giant close up of Firewall's butt to finish it off, but it at least explains why that last panel looked a bit strange, as spotted by Tim.
I am falling down on my job as Talking Joe host, where we read Joe comics and talk about them, because once again, I didn't really read the data desk profiles. They're a little easier to read than I think maybe some previous ones. Mm-hmm. This blue text on sort of a lighter gray. Sorry, I think I'm just a grump, and I'm not really interested in reading four paragraphs of dense text about Joe's in the Devil's Due universe having like Devil's Due adventures that I do or don't know about, and sort of weaving that into Marvel. To our listeners who are big fans of Devil's Due, I'm sorry, but I did, because there is so little of Claymore. I did read the Claymore profile, and I was curious, Mark, if you did, and if you did, what you thought.
Yeah, I think I had the same sort of thought process as you. I do struggle with these data desk entries because there's this sort of big, dense blocks of text in very small font against potentially quite a, you know, not easy to read, you know, color choices. I did read Claymore's for the same reason that you did, and I thought it was interesting expansion of sort of Claymore's profile, given how little they had to work on. And I did sort of reference back to the file card, and they sort of play on this kind of sense of him being a bit of a super Joe, that he's kind of the best of the best of the best. And so there's this funny thing that's in his both his profile here and also his original file card that says something along the lines of, here on his file card, it says this: join the Joe team at the insistence of Hawk. His only stipulation was that he be called in on special assignments only. And, you know, then they go on to say that Hawk agreed. Claymore is respected by all branches of the armed services, and his reputation as a soldier is known far and wide. Very few men have ever seen Claymore, but those who have served him have not and will never forget him. So yeah, it's sort of interesting. It's almost like pinpoint, you know, making him sound like, just if you've got like the Snake Eyes being one of these super Joes who's the best of the best, that we've got Claymore here on the other side, and he's only going to be involved in special missions, none of the normal G.I. Joe humdrum missions that don't justify his special presence.
Folks, there's a big difference between being the best of the best and being the best of the best of the best, and that difference is Claymore.
It's something that Hammer jokes about the Joe's file cards that he doesn't write, that they always sort of show them everyone being the best of the best, the very best, whereas he often sort of will spend half of the file card kind of emphasizing something that is less than the best, like their bad body odor or some such.
To our listeners who are disappointed that I keep not reading these blocks of text in the Devil's Due issues, in my defense, in just about every comic book, if I turn the page and there's a big block of sort of story text, I don't mean like the Marvel bullpen bulletins page, you know, or like a like an editorial from Dick Giordano in a DC book. That stuff I eat up. But and I can't think of many examples, you know, like once or twice in Brian Michael Bendis's Ultimate Spider-Man, you turn the page and he'd have Mark Bagley just draw like one big panel and the entire right third of the page was just a bunch of dialogue that was typed out, not even in word balloons, you know, between like Peter Parker and Felicia Hardy. And I'd think, Bendis, you're this is not a movie and you're not a screenwriter. This is comics. Give us some word balloons. And in some later issues, in some later issues of Cerebus, that get really text heavy. And I like that book a lot. I cannot read those blocks of text. So it's not just G.I. Joe. It's not just Devil's Due, G.I. Joe. I was a little thrown off by the sort of Super Joe-ness of this Claymore data desk page. It is somewhat set up there by Michael Hill's original file card for the toy. And, you know, someone can know at least 10 languages. I mean, people do. And, you know, the American government would recruit some of those people in the military. But it's sort of read as sort of like a superhero to me rather than like a grounded person. And so I thought, okay. All right, next story.
Right, the next story is called Prelude to a Kiss. It was delivered to us via the talents of writer-editor Mike O'Sullivan, pencils Pat Quinn and Tim Seeley, colours Peter Sofranas, and letters Brian J. Crowley.
Plot breakdown.
Cover Girl and Shipwreck's romantic relationship plays out over the years in flashbacks, while in current-day Brazil, they interrupt their holiday to stop a Cobra enclave from kidnapping a senator in Rio Janeiro. I kept that plot briefing short and snappy.
Yes, and it is a short story, so I think a short plot breakdown is warranted. All right, what's your broad reaction to the story?
So broad reaction is it's Mike Sullivan, I think, doing what he quite likes to do, which is kind of filling in gaps in stories and just sort of rounding things out a bit. So in the main title, it was there was a scene where it was revealed that Shipwreck and Cover Girl were now an item. So this story is effectively sort of giving the long version of that story, of rounding out how that all happened beyond like a speech bubble saying that was now a thing. And, you know, he does a nice sort of trip through the history of Shipwreck. They've got a flashback to the maiden voyage after the Battle of New Cobra Island in ARA 41. After the Battle of Springfield in issue 51, there's a scene just after G.I. Joe has been shuttered, the pit has been shuttered from issue 155, and then a couple of scenes sort of relating to sort of in between issues of the Devil's Due era. So it's sort of, you know, got a nice little bit of interplay of walking through history and at the same time sort of telling a kind of a modern day story. The arts seemed sort of relatively simple. The you've got the colours on the flashback scenes in grey. I'm not too sure that entirely works. You kind of lose a little bit of clarity in the telling of having everything all in grey and fairly aggressive greys, which loses some of the art. And I don't know, the art generally just feels a little bit underbaked to some degree.
Yeah, I agree. I thought having each of these scenes be one or two pages and flash back and forth was a cute device. I thought the actual developing of their relationship was fun. each of the flashback scenes gets a title, which reminds me of how Priest writes many of his comics. Christopher J. Priest, who's best known for Deathstroke and Superman Lost recently, and a bunch of Vampirella. But so Pat Quinn pencils the flashbacks, and I don't think he's ready. His acting is good. His compositions are good. His anatomy is good. But the whole thing has this, it's a little bit of an amateurish polish to it. Like on the page that says X marks the spot, you know, like CoverGirl's reaction and then Shipwreck's eye and nose and cheek in profile all the way on the right. You know, it's drawn well, but it could be drawn a lot better. And I can't imagine someone with these pretty good skills drawing this book 10 years earlier at Marvel. And so part of what this story does for me is it reminds me of where Devil's Due was going at this time, which is A, pencils only, no inks, which we've heard about from, was it Mike O'Sullivan when we interviewed him, or was it?
Yeah, I think we talked to it. Okay. To Mike about it. Yeah.
To save money. And so that's a general thing. And then also artist Pat Quinn specifically, and a couple other artists like him who would around now start drawing the main book and also Dreadnoughts Declassified and G.I. Joe Declassified, these mini series that I wanted so much more out of, drawn by more than one person and all of whom were not quite good enough to pull it off. And so this story here, Prelude to a Kiss, the actual story, the actual writing is fun and cute, and I like it. And as a backup, it works. And I appreciate sort of a light touch to filling in some gaps. You know, I don't think you need a mini series to do it. I don't think you need oftentimes a full issue to do it. Maybe a, you know, 10-page backup is just right. You know, Pat Quinn had already drawn for Marvel at this point. He'd drawn two issues of Captain Marvel, the series that starred Genis Vell, the son. That was the Peter David series. And Pat Quinn had written and drawn a book on Perspective, that Blue Line or Blue Line Pro, which they made Bristol pages that you could buy to like make your own comics. They were a publisher that sold like art supplies. So like Pat Quinn had worked professionally, but there's just not enough here.
Mm.
And then compared to Tim Seeley's pages, those are much better. Yet those are pencils only, and there are some rough edges and, you know, sort of cheekbones and textures here and there and outlines where, man, does the story want to be inked? And then you already alluded to the I'll phrase it much harsher than you did, the not very good monochrome work in the flashbacks. It's too dark. It's too similar. There's not enough contrast. There's a lot of rendering that's sort of overly busy. That's not necessary, right? Just imagine if it was done in four different grays, like very light gray, medium gray, and medium dark gray. Just it would pop mm-hmm. so much yeah. more. But you know, like on the second to last page, the first panel under the words "hoisting the sails," there's a lot of detail in that, and it's also all kind of one gray mush.
Yeah, I think what I didn't realize at the time is that I guess the modern day scenes are Tim Seeley and the flashbacks are Pat Quinn. Just to put a nail in that one, because it wasn't immediately obvious to me looking through that, but looking at it again, it is. And I will just note as well that the Pat Quinn pages here aren't particularly exciting. It is clear that he definitely does get better as he goes along. And if you want to see some G.I. Joe, better G.I. Joe art by Pat Quinn, as well as maybe checking out some of his later work, you can have a look at Shane Simic's Comic Art Fans Gallery, where he's commissioned him to do some several sketches. And they're quite bold and exciting images of G.I. Joe characters. So definitely an artist who, you know, improves as he gets on.
Yeah, I was thinking the same thing, and I'm actually, I had this point that I wanted to make just now, which is, though I don't like Pat Quinn's work in 2007, I know it gets better, and I'm looking at a commission he did in 2014 of Taskmaster, the Marvel villain, at comicartfans.com, and it's pencils and inks, and it's gorgeous. Looks like Alan Davis or Paul Peltier. It's the posing is sort of lyrical, the inking is lush, the perspective, the anatomy, the sense of light and dark, the texture is what's shiny. And you know, if this guy wants to draw G.I. Joe now, totally. So I might sound really grumpy when I'm reacting to art from older G.I. Joe comics that I don't think is good enough for my tastes. But, you know, this is not to say, like, you know, permanently disqualified. But, you know, and I was about to say, in terms of the present day scenes that are Tim Seeley, pencils only, coloring's not good there either. It's really pasty. Mm-hmm. On page, it's a page with, it's when Shipwreck's dressed as an eel and Covergirl's dressed as a lamprey. And the first panel is a moray with a fight happening on top of it. It's the whole moray. And she says, "I told you this cockamamie plan wouldn't work." Like, ugh, what is this blue? What is this green? This is like straight from the, you know, those like grade school watercolor plastic containers that are rectangles that have like 6 or 10 colors. You know, it's a little like cake of red, a little cake of orange, a little cake of yellow. This is like, right, this isn't from a tube, but it's from the cake. This is like straight from the tube blue and straight from the tube green, but with a lot of white mixed in. Like these colors look like a first pass. This looked like, okay, now you hand it to the colorist who's actually going to like color it.
Right. But it's quite fun seeing Covergirl in as dressed up as a lamprey. I'll say that.
I'll just say one last thing. Just a little reminder that the last page of this comic book has an ad that mentions Storm Shadow issue number 1.
Mm.
New ongoing series, right, by Larry Hama and Mark Robinson with covers by Sean Murphy. So at this point in G.I. Joe, you know, exciting things are happening. But also in terms of Tim Seeley doing a lot of work and maybe him penciling a few pages for this backup and them not being inked is about saving money. But maybe it's also about schedule. Mm-hmm. The back cover of this comic book has an ad for 3 different Dungeons and Dragons comics miniseries that Devil's Due was publishing at the time. Sorry, one of which is not technically a Dungeons and Dragons book, but it's written by a Dungeons and Dragons guy. But so there's this book, R.A. Salvatore's Demon Wars, and there's a 48-page issue that's being advertised here, penciled by Tim Seeley. So this guy's really busy and is also pitching in on the backup for Special Mercenaries Brazil.
Yeah. I'll bet that was done quickly. Interesting that Storm Shadow advert is split between an advert for G.I. Joe issue 23 and Storm Shadow issue 1, and both parts of that half page have the characters upside down. Unusual.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, let's score this. So overall for me, for the book, I think it's fine. I don't have any, you know, huge objections to it. It's not my favorite. It's not one that I dislike. So, you know, it's a read, but I don't think it sort of progresses the overall lore too much. So somewhere in the middle, like I'll give it a 6.5. It's fine. It passes the time. It, you know, there's a lot to like, but it's not going to set the world on fire.
It's at its best on the front cover and the lead story. There's a lot to enjoy. The book gets weaker as it goes. It is a double-sized comic and I love double-sized comics, and it is.
More is more. That's the phrase, isn't it?
I'll give it a 5.
And just to remind listeners that Tim's 5 is a normal person's 10.
I think my five might be a normal person's eight, but and I just want to say one last time how exciting it is that the Devil Stew folks made use of the Special Missions Brazil characters and concept and color schemes. That's a lot of fun. And so as I'm holding this issue, even though I didn't give it a high number, I have a lot of warm feelings for this comic. Like, yeah, they did it. They did it.
So next time on Talking Joe Disavowed, we will continue our side quest away from the America's Elite book with some more of the specials that were coming out during 2007. Next up will be G.I. Joe versus Transformers 3, The Art of War. We'll follow that up with G.I. Joe versus the Transformers 4, Black Horizon, before delving back into the main America's Elite book with issue 21 through to 24, which was an arc called Sins of a Mother. When we are not talking about the Devil's Due era of G.I. Joe, we'll also be talking about contemporary comics and other things besides. We'll be covering the new issues of A-Rar as they come out, as well as talking about the other titles from the Skybound Energon universe. And if you want to find out more about Talking Joe, you can visit us on our website. Talkingjoe.co.uk is the place to go, which has links to all of our presences everywhere. We're on Facebook, where you can discuss the latest episodes and issues as they come out. We're on Twitter, some say X, I don't. We're on Instagram. We've got a voicemail facility where you can leave us voicemails. Scroll down to the bottom of the page on talkingjoe.co.uk. You can also do things like send us an email. We're on Patreon, patreon.com/talkingjoe. So you can be super cool like our backers: Richard, Sam, Jay, Bill, Christopher, Justin, Rob, Brian, Shane, Ryan, and Simon, who are all getting early access to episodes as well as some exclusive content. Now, Tim, where can people find you when you are not talking to me about comics from 2007?
With my creative partners in New York, we create video essays on TV and film. Our YouTube page is at Atomic Abe. My brick and mortar comic book store is in Somerville, Massachusetts. That's Hub Comics, and that's on all the socials. And I write about G.I. Joe at arealamericanbook.com.
Now, Tim, can I ask you, if someone was trying to buy some comics from the IDW era of G.I. Joe and they were finding super expensive comics elsewhere on the internet, or indeed not even able to find an issue to buy at all, could you give them any sort of recommendation?
Yes. My store has many of the IDW issues still in stock, and a couple of them are super expensive. But many of them are moderately priced or just a bit over cover. But we don't have a web store. We don't have e-commerce. Sorry, I'm too busy writing a book about G.I. Joe and co-hosting a G.I. Joe comics podcast. But if you email the shop at hubcomics@gmail.com, maybe we can work out a deal. And then we would ship to you.
Good stuff. Yeah, I understand that a few people have had big holes in their collection filled thanks to Hub Comics. Cool. So I think that is now us done. But keep this forefront in your mind. Remember that
nobody beats Talking Joe, an international podcast.
Laters.
Deep in the Mato Grosso jungles of Brazil, Captain Claymore of G.I. Joe leads four other members of this elite force. They are Wetsuit, Leatherneck, Dial Tone, and Mainframe. Their mission is to retrieve a downed informational satellite lost somewhere in this dark, savage land before Cobra can get their reptilian hands on it. The security of America depends on it.
All right, men, listen up. This new Voltronic Gala hitter indicates that SATCOM is nearby.
Does it indicate a range?
Probably a few clicks up this jungle path, Wetsuit. And dollars to donuts, Cobra is too, so look sharp.
Captain Claymore, sir?
Yes, Dial Tone?
Why would Cobra want to knock our satellite out of the sky anyway?
SATCOM is our eye in the sky. Every day it receives thousands of pieces of information and numerous intelligence reports from around the world. If Cobra gets a hold of it, they could drive us to our knees.
Then, what are we waiting for?
You're wasting time if you're waiting on me.
All right, let's move out.
Yo, Joe!
Meanwhile, not far away, in another part of the jungle, Cobra Commander, along with Destro and the Baroness, leads his Vipers toward the downed satellite.
According to our sources, the G.I. Joe satellite has fallen very near.
And what about G.I. Joe?
I've arranged a small reception committee for them.
Yes, Destro, darling. G.I. Joe will be the guest of honor at the local native's nocturnal banquet.
Oh, I see.
Now, let's get that satellite. Cobra! Cobra!
Unbeknownst to Captain Claymore, Cobra Commander has engaged a local tribe of savage natives to keep G.I. Joe at bay.
What's that? The rocks in your head.
Those are the drums of the Tupi-Guadmi tribe, and they're aware of our presence. If we don't find that satellite by nightfall, we are in big trouble.
What kind of trouble?
You don't want to know, soldier.
There it is, Captain Claymore. The satellite. And there's Cobra. They've spotted us.
Cobra!
So much for a walk in the park.
Yo, yo!
For 3 long hours, G.I. Joe battled the Cobra Commander and his band of Vipers. Twilight time is now approaching. Soon, it will not be safe for either parties to remain in the jungle.
Cobra Commander! The sun is setting! We must get out of here!
Yes, Commander. Even we can become victims to the horrors of the Tupi-Guadmi. Let G.I. Joe have their precious satellite while we still have our lives.
Coward! I'm surrounded by evil, infamous cowards. On the other hand, we could always come back another time.
Yes, Cobra Commander. Perhaps another time would be a splendid idea.
Now, please, Cobra Commander, advise the Vipers of your new strategy.
Cobra, retreat!
Cobra Commander, Destro, Baroness, and the Vipers retreated back to the safety of their mores and fled down the river to the nearest fort. Meanwhile, Captain Claymore has little time to get his men and the satellite out of the jungle before the sun sets.
Dial tone. Radio us a tomahawk. We're getting ourselves and that satellite out of here.
Yes, sir. Base, this is G.I. Joe. Send us a chopper.
Wetsuit, Leatherneck, secure that satellite for transport.
Yes, sir.
Mainframe, keep a sharp eye. We only have a few minutes of daylight left.
You got it, Captain.
The seconds tick away as the sun merges with the horizon. It casts a golden glow along the jungle ceiling. Time is running out for Captain Claymore and the Joes. Will the tomahawk arrive in time?
All right. Anchor the satellite and climb on board. We're out of here.
Yo!
Once again, G.I. Joe is victorious in their never-ending battle against Cobra and their minions. But they can never rest on their laurels, because Cobra can and will strike again, anytime and any place. Go, Joe!
Thank you.